So here he is. There's my cousin Abraham.
Oh yeah, it's my goodness.
So, and people were like, yeah, we see the resemblance through the smile.
Kathleen Brandt is a regular at the National Archives in Kansas City. She spends a lot of time there helping African Americans find out more about their genealogy. Today, she's showing a volunteer a photo of her white cousin, Abraham.
It's kind of a funny scenario where you have these cousins that we say we're cousins. It's like our grandparents said it, our great grandparents said it. But
All
I
part
have
of the
to,
human family, in other
yeah,
words.
exactly.
For African Americans, tracing a family's history has its own particular challenges. People were uprooted, leaving not just places, but also stories behind. Then there was slavery, lost records. All these things become part of that search for a family's past. I'm Gina Kaufman. Today on KCUR's Central Standard, we're going to explore local efforts to uncover some of those stories. Let's get back to the National Archives, where our intern, Glenn Frizzell, went to meet with Kathleen Brandt. Glenn had tried in the past to learn more about his grandfather's story, but he hit a wall when he was told that all the records that might tell him what he wanted to know had been lost in a fire.
And what is your ancestor's name?
Sylvester.
Sylvester.
Frizzell.
Frizzell, is that correct? Is
One
it?
Z.
One Z. There we go. So all we have here is that we do know that his death was reported
And there's Granddad.
to the Veterans Affair. His birth date is given, his death date is given, and this just is telling us that we want to see that file. We want to see if there's a VA file for him because this is in what we call the Burroughs Death File, which is the military file for burials. We also see that there's an enlistment record within the system. Again, it's the same person. We could see that he's from Mississippi, and we could again go and research further to get the original files.
That is so awesome. That is so awesome. It makes me want to take off from work today and start the research right now.
Glenn isn't alone in the giddiness he feels at finding new clues that might unlock his family's past. The resources he just discovered will be part of a program this coming weekend at the Mid-Continent Public Library, inviting African Americans to use records from slavery and the Civil War to hopefully learn more about their own lineage. Genealogist Kathleen Brandt will be a speaker at that event, and she's with us in the studio now. Kathleen, was Glenn's request pretty typical?
It is typical. It is typical amongst not only the African Americans, but of course everyone looking for Civil
People.
War records. Yes.
What did you mean when you told him that everything you found pertaining to his grandfather kind of signaled a file you wanted to go dig through? Can you explain that a little more?
Sure. Civil records, the personnel files, are held at the National Archives in Washington, D.C. We call it Archives One. And they are filed by soldier's name. And in Glenn's case, his family was in the U.S. Colored Troops. So the USCT, those records are together, and we would find his ancestors' records also there.
What kinds of materials might you reasonably hope to find on that particular paper trail?
We can find everything from where he served, under who, what company and regiment he served. We might be able to get pension records, which is just filled with genealogical goodness, I like to say. It can tell us everything from his wives, if he had a slave wife, if he had a civil wife, if he had children. It would have testimonies and depositions in it. So it is really a treasure trove of research for African Americans who are looking to link their ancestors before the Civil War.
You mentioned the U.S. Colored Troops. Who were they?
The U.S. Colored Troops was a union, and they were allowed, the African Americans at that point, slaves, ex-slaves, and free colors, and I mentioned all three. They were allowed to enlist in the military, especially the Army. We always see them in the waters, in the Navy, but especially in the Army. And they normally fought under a white captain or leader, and they did a regular fighting for their civil rights. They fought for their own freedom.
What are some of the different ways that African Americans did get involved in that fight? I mean, there wasn't just one pathway to involvement, it sounds like.
I believe you're referring to being a soldier, being a cook, being cavalry. There were everything, whatever pertained. And also the civilians were involved with helping and assisting with giving services and materials that were needed, as well as food. So there's so much that the African Americans, ex-slaves, slaves, abolitionists, all assisted in.
Missouri does have what to me was kind of an unexpected story within all of this, because it was one of the few slave states that didn't secede from the Union. So through something called General Order 329, you actually had slaves enlisted to serve in Union forces. And that is so interesting. I mean, how did slaves, still owned, of course, by slaveholders, come to fight for the Union in the Civil War? You'd think that that would be contentious, assuming their owners would be pro-slavery and would therefore support the Confederacy, not the Union.
So there are two ways that they fought, especially in the border states, which included Kentucky and Delaware, parts of West Virginia also will see this. And what happened is that they fought for the Union because their masters might have given them permission. They might have been a sympathizer of the Union. And Missouri was still under the provost marshal jurisdiction. So every man, white and black, was listed as a potential soldier. In saying that, the African-American or ex-slave at this point, he was able to fight if he was able to escape from a Confederate maybe owner, or a owner who did not believe in the Union, or he was given permission. Either way, he was considered free once he got to a USCT troop or a Union camp.
So that equaled freedom, like arriving within that camp?
That's correct.
Wow. So but I have also heard, just in exploring this a little bit, you know, that that slave owners would be compensated for the slave's service in the military, which is bizarre on a number of levels.
Only the border states were compensated for the slave commission records. And we have those records. We can tell if your slave master or your slaveholder ancestor was compensated up to $300 for each slave. It could be $100 for enlistment or $300 for being drafted. Actually, just the opposite, $100 for being drafted, $300 for being enlisted. And we have those records. They're called the slave commissions, the slave claims commission.
It's so complicated, because then you think about that, basically thinking about Union forces on some level participating in an exchange of human property.
Okay, so the Slave Claims Commission came into effect much later, more like 1871. And at that same time, there was also other ways of compensating people who lost property in the Union. And those are the Southern claims. So that's where a lot of Southern claims were made in the Confederacy states, that for those who were sympathizers of the Union, and they had to prove their loyalty.
I knew that African Americans served in the Civil War, but the specifics of that history, especially as it relates to this enlistment of slaves, which was very particular to just Missouri and a few other states, is totally new to me. Why do you think more of us don't learn about that as just part of either living in the state of Missouri or part of learning history?
It's for the same reason most people don't even realize there are such things as free colors. They think all African Americans are descendants of slavery, which is, of course, not true. We have early emancipations. We rarely hear about those who were emancipated before the Civil War. We just think that the textbooks are not designed to teach a true American history.
Is it that we want to teach, like, that there's only one story, or?
It seems to me that way, and that's the way I was taught, however, in the schools. However, my father was a historian, so he was able to share with us a lot more, the different resources that showed us that this is not true. And of course, we have all the documents to prove this isn't true. We also have documents to prove that there were African Americans who fought in the Confederacy because they were free colors for the exact same reason that a white person would fight, and that is they had lots of land. They were landowners first. And we're taught in a lot of times in school that the only time a black person owned a slave was because it was a family member, and that is so not true. And we have, again, many documents to prove that.
At this weekend's genealogy event, you'll be using some tools to help people unlock their own histories. And a couple of those tools you've already mentioned, the Slave Claims Commission and the Southern Claims Commission, that there are how do those tools help people search for their family's stories?
Because they had to prove loyalty. There are witnesses and depositions, slaveholders, matter of fact, in the Southern claims, those who were loyal to the Union. What they had to do was prove that they were loyal to the Union. But in doing so, they needed these witnesses, and the best witnesses were the slaves, their own slaves. And the commissioner of the Southerner claims they preferred that the slaves are the ones who witnessed. And those are the people that we see who presented a slave as a witness, and that those are the ones who actually were awarded their money, their claim. So as far as the entire depositions, we find out relationships. We find out information on the plantation. We find out what kind of owner. We find all kinds of children and kinships and names that we might not have before. And this is great record, by the way, for both slaves and slaveholders.
Yeah. I mean, what do you learn about a slaveholder?
Mostly their financial gain, but the biggest thing that I love to use it for is kinships. So let's say your last name is Smith, and there are several Smiths in the area. In this case, which Smith was your ancestor, and which ones were his brothers? Because there's some cousins in the area.
And that would have come up in these
exactly.
Sort of proofs of loyalty?
Exactly, because it would say, I am Joseph Smith, John Smith's brother. And then it might say later, I am George Smith, John Smith, and Joseph Smith's brother. So in this case, the questions were so clear that it painted a really beautiful picture of families.
So would it ever have happened, though, that a slave would have said before this commission, no, I really don't think my slave owner is loyal to the Union?
It does happen.
Really?
We have actually had some that stood up and actually talked to the commissioner or the agent long enough that by the time the interview was over, the agent was pretty sure it was a Confederate slave owner and possibly a Confederate slave owner who was trying to hide property from the Union.
Property in the form of human beings?
No. Horses, cows, land, actual tangible property.
So what did this slave owner stand to gain or lose from the outcome of this whole process?
The slave owner actually got compensated from the Southern claims also, just like the slave claims. Slave Claims Commission allowed you on border states to claim your actual slave who went into the Union military. The Southern Claims Commissioner was for Union loyalists who were in a Confederacy-type Southern state. They were able to say, we supported the Union, and we lost money on that. We lost horses. We supported them with food. We supported them with shelter of some sort that turned into a financial loss, and that's what they gained. They gained actual finances. They had more money coming into them from the federal government.
When you're in the habit of associating the Union with freedom and the Confederacy with slavery, it is such a funny thing to think of a slave owner demonstrating through the testimony of slaves loyalty to the Union.
Yes. However, at the time, there's so many different kinds of records. Some slave owners, their slaves didn't even work on their own plantation. They worked on other plantations. It was a financial gain. And if we think of the slaves as a way of financial gain, it makes sense. The biggest difference is we always had those who were personal slaves and a preferred or a favorite slave. So these people also still kept in touch with their masters even after the war. Even if they saw the ugliness, they also saw the protection perhaps. And the view point from the slave was that's all they knew. And having said that, if you don't know differently, what do you say? And remember, this is around 1871. So this is only 5, 6, 7 years after slavery and after a custom way of living. And they haven't necessarily grown their true independence yet.
So the result of this whole process of slaveholders trying to prove loyalty to the Union is this Southern Claims Commission, Slave Claims Commission. Do you have stories of people who have come to you in their genealogical searches, having hit some kind of wall in their efforts to learn more about their ancestry, and these records have been game changers?
Oh, yes. These are what I call brick wall game changers, because it will bring down a brick wall in both the slaveholder and the slave's families. So this should not be overlooked by anyone, actually, the Southern claims or the slave claims. Because remember, you're hearing witnesses from family members. You're hearing depositions are given from the slave, ex-slave, and communities. And in this case, we sometimes have to study an entire community of depositions.
Can you give an example?
Sure. One of my favorite cases was a wonderful woman in the South, and she had had several husbands, 3 husbands, matter of fact. And at the point, she was still married, but she had inherited her land from her father. So it was her land. The first 2 husbands had died, and the Confederacy came up and asked for, and this is the Confederacy came up and asked for food and supplies. And she went on the front porch with her pistol and dared them to take it. She was a very strong woman. In that case, when it came to Union loyalty, we heard from her slaves and we heard from the agent of how loyal she was throughout the Civil War, how she assisted the slaves, and she was able to name slaves, and how she also assisted her family in hiding slaves and helping them get away. So these stories are in there, and they're in detail.
Who was it who was searching for that? Was it one of her relatives or one of her slaves' descendants?
Slave descendant, yes. In this case, it was one of her slave holder and a slave descendant, and that was my point, is that they ended up meeting one another.
Wow.
And a lot of times we're seeing now through DNA that a lot of people are related, and the picture of a family unit is changing. But beside that, we're finding that there's this connection because these ancestors came from the same area.
We've got to take a short break. Genealogist Kathleen Brandt, stay with me, okay?
Okay.
When we return, we'll explore how diaspora, slavery, and oppression in some ways shape what local people know about their own stories. If you've had an experience tracing your ancestry through slavery and beyond, call in and tell us about it. 816-235-2888. Welcome back to KCUR's Central Standard. I'm Gina Kaufman, here with genealogist Kathleen Brandt. She's speaking at a program this Sunday at the Mid-Continent Public Library's Midwest Genealogy Center, where people can research their history, their ancestry. Kathleen's giving 2 presentations, one called Claim It, Civil War Treasures, and the other is all about making use of the Slave Claims Commission records and Southern Claims Commission records in your research. This whole program got us thinking about whether the history of being uprooted and brought to this continent, then enslaved, complicates what it means to know about one's own past for African Americans today. Kathleen, what do you think?
It makes it a little more challenging than those who can follow church records like our Swedish ancestors or Norwegian ancestors. It is challenging because they also lost their humanness in a surname. They didn't have surnames, and some of them only had partial names. We have one slaveholder in down south who did do a Southern claims, by the way, and in his, he named all 401 slaves on his plantation by name. In general, we don't have that. In general, we have them identified as mulatto or black or yellow. It doesn't even give us a name.
So just by skin tone?
Skin tone and age.
Wow. So, I mean, that seems like it would be a hard thing to even begin to try and work through. How do people do it, other than some of the tools we've just talked about?
Well, what makes it a little more complicated is that slaves, after freedom, after their emancipation, they did not necessarily take their owner's last name or their last slave owner's names. So that's why we are looking for some of the records we mentioned earlier, is because we want to know who was the slave master of this slave. But on the slave census is the best way I can call it, 1850 and 1860, it will mention male 16 mulatto. And in that, we're trying to trace your family to be associated with a particular slaveholder. It's a puzzle.
Yeah, it sounds like, I mean, it sounds like a really, really hard puzzle that, like, almost where the odds of solving it are just minuscule, but maybe I'm just a pessimist.
Well, of course, we have one more wonderful tool nowadays, and that's DNA. So that also helps us cluster families together. And no, we can actually match and find records. We're looking for records, though, with names in it, whether it's a military pension file or the Southern claims or maybe a diary, a wills, a probate. I found my own ancestor in a probate and will. He was given his name that Wiley was supposed to be given to the slaveholder's wife. And of course, I had already tracked Wiley, and his last name was Morse, and he did meet the DNA of the Morses, so I know that he was a descendant of this family.
How do they have DNA records from before people knew about DNA? I mean, how can you make those connections between the past and the present in that way?
Excellent question. So what we do with DNA is they have taken samples across the world, and they've gone what we call the old country. So they would have gone to Ireland, people who have never left Ireland for generations and generations, and taken their DNA samples, and then they start matching in America to see if these Americans are matched to any group of an Irish. And I use Irish a lot because my family is of also Irish blood on my mother's side. Then we also have the same thing is happening in the German, and certain things, and the same is happening in Africa or in Asia, in certain Native American and in Jewish heritages. So because of that, we're able to match what we consider family units or bloodlines, and then we can put them in the family units.
So I'm curious from our callers, have you run up against these issues when digging for your family's past? Has your family's cultural heritage affected what you do and don't know about your story? 816-235-2888. Kathleen, how did you get into genealogy? Are there specific questions that African Americans tend to ask about their own past a part of your interest in this work?
So I got into genealogy in about 2000 after retiring from corporate America. And in this case, I was just interested in my own family. I had always heard stories that we were Native American. I even was able to get Native American monies from the University of Michigan because my grandmother sent proof that I was Native American and no one else had claimed it. However, it turned out that in our DNA, we are not Native American. And this is a very common story that it happens with African Americans is that we're told that we're Native American mixture. And I don't know when Native American became quite vogue, but this is a common story. So I started researching, if that's not true, what else isn't true? And because of the historical ramifications of ex-slaves in one side of my family are free colors, and the others, as I mentioned, are Irish, I really was intrigued with the fact of all the mixtures that I had. And my family was from central Kansas as early as the 1880s. And this is out near Comanche and Coldwater, where the other African Americans had not settled. They settled mostly in Nicodemus and Topeka area, which we call Tennessee Town. So for me, my family was just an enigma.
And it sounds like what you were doing is kind of comparing what people had told you, whatever details you could find out, with what you knew about kind of history with a capital H.
Exactly. So storytelling is a great place that we start with genealogy. We write down the facts that we know, who's our mother or father and who are our grandparents, who are, you know, if we know maybe a great grandparent, we start with the facts. And then from there, we remember all the stories. And so the point at that time is, can we prove the story? There was a fellow who recently wrote a book named David Jackson. It's called Born a Slave. And in Born a Slave, he is a white fellow, and he's here in Kansas City. And he realized that his ancestor really was a slave, and that was about four or five generations back. The book is wonderful. It is called Born a Slave. And he talks about how he realized and how he discovered this. And this is what we do daily in genealogy. We are unturning the history that we know, and we're learning the real American history.
Because an individual story can just deviate that much from the narrative that we've heard that's supposed to include everyone.
Exactly. I'm sorry.
No, please go on.
In my family alone, I can debunk most of the things you've learned about history.
Wow. Can you give an example?
Sure. Miscegenation has occurred in our family since the early 1800s.
What is that?
Mixed marriages. Mixed marriages have occurred early in our family, and has occurred through the generations, as well as the free colored side has been an eye-opener of being a landowner as early as 1817, or having a Revolutionary War soldier who fought and was given his freedom, and therefore all of his heirs were free. So there's so much in just my family. And on the other hand, on my slave research, I was able to go back to the 1700s very easily on my father's side, and that's out of Kentucky. So it's not just my North Carolina, my Kansas, and my Kentucky, and my Irish side. I have been able to learn so much about history through it.
Kathleen, as you've mentioned, it's become sort of popular to use DNA to unlock some of these stories. There are a lot of television shows about it. It's a celebrity pastime, kind of, to use DNA to find out where they come from, and by extension, to uncover possible secrets, I guess, about their own, often about their own racial and ethnic makeup. What do you think is going on with that trend?
It's a wonderful tool for genealogy. And as a researcher for several of those TV shows, I can tell you that we use it to help us move quickly through the generations and to make sure and to verify our work. So it's a way of verifying. A lot of times I say, there's someone hanging from your tree that is not a relative. And in that case, we want to pluck those people, because when we're just doing it by guessing or name recognition, it doesn't always work. And it normally doesn't, matter of fact. So DNA, it gives us a verification of family bloodlines, and it gives us also a great view at our ethnicity.
How does it affect you to know what was going on in your family tree, like four, five, six generations ago, maybe even further back? I mean, how does it change your self-concept, or does it?
I'm not sure exchange is a self-concept. However, it does give you a sense of knowing who you are, where you came from, the advantages and disadvantages that your ancestors not only had, but that you actually can overcome just because you know that they did.
Do you, I mean, there's so much understandable happiness when it comes to stumbling on new information or meeting a relative you've never known about. Like, if that happened to me, I would be ecstatic. But are there ever disappointments? I mean, have you ever helped people cope with something they've learned, information that maybe, yeah, disappoints them about their own relatives, their own ancestors?
Absolutely. Some people are embarrassed by the criminals and those who have served in prisons. And we've done those even for the TV shows where we've shown them these prison records. This is where your great-grandmother went to prison. Here are her records. But my answer is we don't change history. What we do is accept it, know these things happen. We also have people who are embarrassed that they had slave ancestors or that they had a woman who ran off with another man back in the 1860s. These things happen. It's life. And I work with them into accepting history as it is, not rewriting it.
Do you think that that there are sort of new frontiers in genealogy that we should be looking forward to, particularly, you know, for people who come from backgrounds where there are particular challenges related to, you know, anything from, like you were saying, with slavery, with there being people not even being named in their own records? It's so funny to think about technology and new developments as helping you uncover something in the past. But are there any new developments that you think are going to change things for people with these struggles to find out their stories?
Every day we find new records, and these records help tell us the story. These paper records, some that we think were lost and they might be buried in the bottom of the National Archives or a museum or in someone's attic. So in those cases, we find things every day. Sometimes I just tell my clients, it's time to wait. Just wait until we find that DNA match. Or especially that with adoption, people who have adoptions in their family line, those are a little harder. Again, DNA helps us a lot in cracking those cases. But also we have to know more about the areas and the locations.
Well, let's go ahead and talk with Cassandra in Kansas City. Hi, Cassandra.
Hello.
What can you share?
Well, I am excited because I am going to the seminar Saturday. But my question is, I am doing my family tree, and on my father's side, I am at a roadblock. I have them all the way up to like 1900, and then I cannot find them anymore. They're in Oklahoma, so I don't know if it's Indian tribe, if it's that they came, you know, my grandfather's father says he was born in Tennessee, so I don't know if it was like they escaped from slavery or, you know, what, but I am pulling out my eyelashes trying to find more information on my father's side, on my mother's father's side.
Kathleen, what can you tell our caller?
So, Cassandra, be sure to speak to me and come up and introduce yourself on Saturday. But to get started on this case, you have only gotten to 1900s. There's something that we should all know that happened after the Civil War, and that is a lot of African Americans changed their names. They were allowed to change their names and come up with any name, surname, and alias that they wanted. And they could register it, and for that day forth, they can use this new name. So in my own ancestry also, in about 1880s, I couldn't find any of these people. And what I did was I started taking what we call family clusters, and I was able to realize that my Cora that I knew in Kansas, who was born in the 1880s, back in the 1880s, she was not Cora, she was Pimble, P Pemble, it looked like, P-E-M-B-O-L-E. So in finding and looking for family members, we have to look for clusters.
Kathleen Brandt, Chief Genealogist for A3 Genealogy, it's been great having you on the show this morning. Kathleen will be part of a big event on researching your African American roots at the Mid-Continent Public Library this Sunday. For details, go to mycmcpl.org.